So feel free to come up at the end to get this information. Any questions on what we're going to be doing here this week? Great. Yes, the litany. The sheet that I passed out at the beginning. On the one side, which is labeled page 4, is a Kyrie or a litany, and I'd like us to begin with that. Does everyone have one or can see one? On the left-hand column, then, I will be the leader and you all be the people. As you walked in the garden with Adam and Eve,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
As you watched Jacob walk to meet his brother Esau,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
As you led your people through the desert with a pillar of fire,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
As you inspired Ruth to faithfully follow Naomi,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
As you walked with your disciples healing and preaching,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
As you joined Cleopas and his companion on the road to Emmaus,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
As you traveled with Paul and Timothy on their missionary journeys,
Come to me, yes, O Lord.
Amen.
Amen.
So I think we want to begin, or I would like to begin this morning with just hearing from you what you know already about accompaniment, what you know already about global mission. So I want to kind of throw that wide open. That will help us just kind of know where we go in our discussion this morning. How many of you have been involved in global mission in one way or another, or have some global mission experiences maybe to share with the others in the group? Somewhere over here.
Well, we had a young person from our church serve in Argentina one year right after college.
Okay.
The youth part of the global mission.
Okay.
But even listening to her afterwards and hearing from other people, I don't remember the concept of accompaniment. So one of the reasons I came is I want to know what that is. So I thought I knew a little bit, but there's a lot I don't know.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that and being honest with us about that. That helps us to know where to go with this too. Others who have experience with global mission, maybe something to share about what they know or have experience with global mission, or particularly about the concept of accompaniment?
We worked in Papua New Guinea with a former global mission volunteer for 3 weeks. Okay. And while I don't know the exact definition, I would assume it to be what we felt was walking with the people where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And plugging into their lives, and you know, treading lightly on where they're at.
Yeah, great. Anyone else with experiences of global mission or ideas about the concept of accompaniment? Things that you've heard or experienced? No. Okay. Yes.
Just, I was curious because I've been a member of the LARCH community in Tacoma, Washington. I don't know if anybody's familiar with LARCH. And that's a term, accompaniment's a term used to kind of walk together with a single person on their journey. So
okay.
I was wondering what the similarities were.
Okay. And how is that, I mean, walk together with the person, what in what ways?
It's intentional. It's like
okay.
an intentional, not quite a mentor, but somebody to act as a sounding board as you experience a pretty intense, particularly for younger people, but also for people who have been in LARCH a long time, that the what it brings up in you in the process of your experience
okay.
there.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any others? Well, it's in some ways not surprising that even those of you who have been involved in global mission in your congregations or have some experience, that there's still some questions about the concept of accompaniment. I wouldn't say that it's a brand new concept, but it's still one that we in the ELCA are trying to get out in front of people quite a bit and trying to spread a little bit farther and wider. It's a concept that has its roots in a lot of different biblical images, and one in particular, I hope that some of you grab Bibles on the way in, one story in particular that I think really helps us define the concept of accompaniment. And so I'd like to begin, or I guess I've now this is the third or fourth beginning, right? I would like to take a look at that story. It's in Luke 24, verses 13 to 35. And I would like us to read this together, and the way I would suggest that we'll read it together is using a style of Bible reading that that I do quite often with some of our co-workers, Senegalese co-workers, who meet at least weekly, if not sometimes more than that, for Bible study in the setting where I'm working. And that's just volunteers begin reading. Read until they feel like stopping. Well, when you do, when that person stops, you say the verse that comes next. So if I'm, because we have a lot of different translations going. So if I, for instance, read two or three verses, I would just stop by saying 17. And that person would pick up, whoever wanted to volunteer next would pick up at 17. So kind of giving the cue to the next person. Yeah, so we're looking at Luke 24, 13 to 25. And I'll begin just to model that a little bit. And I would just invite any other volunteers to jump in, read a verse or two, a couple of verses. And when you're done reading, say the verse that's coming next so the next person will know where to pick it up. From Luke 24, beginning with verse 13. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. 17.
And he said to them, "What is this conversation which you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor into Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" 19.
He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him." 21.
But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. 24.
Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared."
I'm going to go to 35, I'm sorry.
Oh.
yeah.
Well, was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all of the scriptures. 28.
As they came near the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he were going further. But they held him back, saying, "Stay with us. This day is almost over, and it's getting dark." He went in to stay with them. He sat to eat with them, and took the bread, and said the blessing. Said the blessing. Then he broke the bread and gave it to them. 31.
Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?"
That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. 34.
They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
Thank you to all of you for sharing in that reading. Just briefly, let's summarize the story, beginning with who are the main characters involved in this story?
Cleopas, Jesus.
And some other person.
Some other person, an unnamed person. It's interesting, a lot of biblical scholars have said because this person is unnamed, we might assume it's a woman. I think that's possibly an assumption that is there, but not necessarily. But so two followers of Jesus, Cleopas and another one, and Jesus. And where are they? Where does this story take place?
Going to Emmaus.
Going to Emmaus, okay. And where's Emmaus?
7 miles. A suburb.
Right. Yeah. 7 miles. Seven mile walk from Jerusalem. And when does this take place?
Sunday.
On Sunday of the resurrection.
Okay, Sunday of the resurrection. Great. And just a brief summary of the plot. What happens first? What are the two who are walking? Well, they're walking. What else are they doing as they're walking?
Discussing the weekend's events.
Okay, discussing the weekend's events. Right.
It doesn't say why they're going there, though.
Doesn't say why they're going to Emmaus. No. Maybe they live there. Maybe they're coming back from Jerusalem. We don't know.
I would think that would be true because they asked him to come to their home.
To their home, that's right.
Because it was getting late.
Yeah. So they're walking on the road. They're talking about the weekend's events. We don't exactly know why they're going there. We might assume that they're going home having been in Jerusalem. What else happens as they're walking and talking together?
A man approaches them, who we know to be Jesus, but they don't recognize.
Right, right. We have the benefit of being in with the author who tells us right away that it's Jesus. They don't know that, but we do. So it's Jesus walking with them. And what does Jesus do as he's walking with them?
What are you talking about?
Okay, yeah, so he butts in. Jumps into their story, right. Sorry? What else?
Oh, he joins in.
Joins in, yeah, okay.
I don't know if that was a tradition of the day to...
Right, yeah. I don't know either. I don't know if that was something that walkers always did, jumped into the conversation, or if that was a particularly forward thing to do. But he joins them in the conversation and asks them what they're talking about, joins in the conversation, maybe completes some of the thoughts that they are having. And as they're going on, someone's already said, he again, the author lets us know that he makes as if he's going to continue. He maybe wants to stay, but isn't going to impose himself. And they invite him to come into the house. And then what? Kind of near the climax of the story then?
He breaks the bread and blesses it, and then their eyes are open to who he really is.
Right, right. So he is given the honor, the privilege of saying the blessing for their meal, and as he breaks the bread, he's known to them, he's revealed to them to be Jesus.
And then he disappears.
And then disappears, right, right. And they, just to complete the story then, what do they do?
Their eyes are open.
Their eyes are open, yep. And as a result of their eyes being open,
they go back to Jerusalem.
Back to 7 miles to Jerusalem. I always assume running. They came walking to Emmaus and ran back to Jerusalem.
Did they do that night?
Pardon me?
Did they do that night?
That would be at night if they got up immediately and it was already evening, having the evening meal. So they've run back at night to Jerusalem, where they encounter who?
The rest of them.
The rest of them, right? The rest of the followers, and share what they've experienced of Christ. And what do the other followers share with them?
The story of the angel. And the finding of the empty tomb.
Okay, so they're sharing with them the story of the empty tomb, the encounter with the angel. So Each of them now has their experience of the risen Christ that are different from one another, and they share those stories with one another.
But they must not have known about the resurrection when they were on the walk.
That's what we would assume, because they're sad about the fact that he has died.
Right.
If they knew about the resurrection, one would assume they wouldn't. That wouldn't be where their emotions were stuck. So, yeah. Well, this, in many ways, is the biblical paradigm for what we call accompaniment. And to summarize what accompaniment is, quite simply, it's walking together, as somebody said, walking together with the people, sharing the road, sharing our stories, including our questions, and as we discovered in reading and knowing the author's point of view, doing that as Christians, we know that in walking with the other, we will encounter Christ. That Christ will be with us in that walk, in that encounter, although we may not always know it, although we may not always see it. And then arriving at a particular destination, sharing bread with one another, sharing resources and meals with one another, Christ is in fact revealed to us in the breaking of the bread, in the breaking open of our relationships, in the breaking open of our resources as we share them with one another. This is, in a nutshell, what accompaniment is. Now the question becomes, as we move from that biblical image, what exactly does this mean for how the church carries out global mission, or how the church is involved in God's mission in the world? And so that's what we want to talk about a little bit now with that image before us. And I have some handouts that I'm going to hand around here too. We're not going to go line by line through these, but just some resources for you to read maybe afterwards, or kind of fill in some of the blanks some questions about this.
How many did you make?
I made 20. Yes. We can make more if people have need of these.
Yeah.
Don't you think that in comparing it with modernity, news really travels fast? Mm-hmm. 7 miles to Emmaus and they heard about everything that was going on with Pontius Pilate and everything, and they decided to go to Jerusalem to see what all the commotion was about, and maybe on Thursday.
Perhaps, although it says that they were followers of Jesus, so I assume in the story that where it begins is that they have been with Jesus, they have followed him to Jerusalem, were with him at the time of the events in Jerusalem. And as the disciples kind of scattered, we read in other parts of the Good Friday story that the disciples scattered. They all went their own way. And the way that Cleopas and the other disciples, the unnamed disciple, the follower, went was toward Emmaus, perhaps toward their own home. So what brought them to Jerusalem, I think, was having followed Jesus to be there. That's my interpretation of it, typically, that they were already in Jerusalem.
Well, they didn't know about the resurrection. They did know about the empty tomb, because they had heard about, they're talking about that on the road, about that the woman found that the tomb was empty. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what that meant,
right?
But they did know there was an empty tomb.
Right, because you're right. So they had, thank you, that was, they talked about the empty tomb, but not about the, they had not yet heard of someone encountering the risen
right.
Christ. That's what becomes news to them when they rejoin the other group. That's right. That's right. So just a little background then on having this kind of biblical image in front of us in a real practical sense. In the mid-1990s, and probably even before that, there's a growing sense within many different churches, and particularly in the ELCA, of wanting to take a look at how it is that we're engaging in global mission, and looking at what the paradigm had been for mission throughout the centuries. And now whether that is the paradigm we wanted to continue, or if we're being called to reconsider, based on biblical images and other stories, how it is that we think about global mission. And one of the large trends within that is simply a kind of rediscovery of the concept of Missio Dei. How many of you know Latin? I don't either. So, but Missio, what do you guess that means?
Mission.
And Dei, God. God's mission. that the starting point for the Lutheran Church or any other church being involved in global mission is God's mission. That God, from the beginning, has been involved in mission, has had a mission, has been a missionary God, sometimes we say it that way. That God is active in the world with a mission to reach to people, to restore creation, to bring good news to people. And that we as Christians enter into God's mission. So it's something that's been there throughout the history of the church, and yet something we have to remind ourselves of, because we're used to talking about the church's mission, or perhaps our church's mission, or something very specific, my mission, or our mission in another place. And so typically, in the former paradigm of mission, there was always an image of those of us being somewhere, being sent somewhere else, that was mission, going out to another place, going to somewhere that didn't have the gospel, going to a people that hadn't heard. And now the way of rethinking that, not to say that we don't go anymore, but much more that it's not just that we're here going somewhere else, but rather that everyone who is involved in God's mission is called to participate in God's mission, to walk on the road together, to share in mutuality with those with whom we're trying to communicate the gospel. So this is something, as I said, it says in the paper there, in the mid-1990s, a conversation that came out particularly from the Latin American experience, when groups of the churches with whom the ELCA was working, particularly in Latin America, were consulted, were brought together to say, to be in a conversation with those in the ELCA to talk about how it is that we are engaged in mission and ministry. And I'll just read a quote there on page 2, the first full paragraph. This conversation acknowledged that good things have been achieved through the faithful service of missionaries and mission agencies. Churches have been started, education and healthcare has been provided, for example. On the other hand, local culture was often denied or ignored. Local people were excluded from decision-making, and local churches experienced dependency rather than autonomy in their relationship with mission agencies. So looking at some of the kind of perceived problems or deficits with the way that we were engaging in ministry or the way that we were thinking about ministry, that we had something to offer to someone who has nothing, was building this sort of dependency, building a sort of top-down or a superiority sort of complex in our mission work. And so a new way of thinking about this and going back to the images of the Bible of walking together was where this concept of accompaniment then came from. If anyone has questions at any point, just jump in. I want this, like we said before, to be as sort of dialogical as possible. So walking together in mission with other people means that we really need to consider other people's experiences, consider other people's viewpoints and the cultural backgrounds that they have, rather than imposing on other people a way of doing things, a way of organizing, a way of seeing things. It means that there's a lot of listening and not so much talking. It means consulting with one another, and it means, in a real practical sense, that these churches now that have been started as a result of all the years of missionary work are now more primarily responsible for their own vision for mission in their own territories, in their own places where these churches exist. And that more and more than the ELCA, rather than directing for people in other places what their mission and ministry will look like, but rather walking with them, serving when invited to help them realize and implement their vision for ministry.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Maybe you plan to get this later, but
yeah.
I'm curious about the role of conversion in all of this. Are you going into communities that are already Christian, or are you speaking for groups that are going into places where there isn't a lot of Christianity with the intention of spreading the word?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one of the things that comes into one of the variations that we'll be talking about a little bit later or later in the week. But one of the sort of basic understandings of accompaniment is that as a result of these years, centuries of missionary work, there is some form of the Christian church in nearly every country in the world. Now, we can debate that exactly, whether that's true in every single country as countries redivide and how established is the church and things like that. But really understanding that in most places in the world, there is some expression of the church. And so the primary responsibility that we have now as the ELCA, as a church body in North America, is to assist and to accompany and to walk with those Christians in those places, rather than having a vision on our own to go to a place, bring something new there, whether it's conversion or even other sorts of community development projects or something like that, independent of the Christians who are from that place on the ground there, helping them to better implement their own vision for mission, helping them even to have the capacity, to have the ability to do better with the things that they feel that God is calling them to do in their own context. So it has the understanding that Christians in those places know the context better than we could ever know the context, and ask us to assist them in that. So I know that doesn't answer exactly the question, but I hope it got to it a little bit. Yeah. Thank you for asking.
Well, I was just going to add too that there are certainly churches and missionaries, religious groups who are doing that, and the spectrum to the extent to which they, as the outsider, come in and are seeking to convert other people, they themselves do that directly or make use of neighbors or other indigenous leaders within the community. There's a broad spectrum of that, but I think accompaniment is pretty far. The ELCA's model of accompaniment is pretty far to one side of the spectrum.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I got a little distracted there.
Could I ask a question?
Please,
do you see this being implemented also in the United States? As we have more and more of our Hispanic culture and various cultures coming in, and I'm aware that there is, ELCA is trying to develop them, and yet I would say this philosophy, I think, has got to get stronger. We're trying more to make them fit into our square holes rather than allowing them to be who they are. Mm-hmm. And so I was curious, does the U.S. recognize this same concept in we're not global, but we are global.
Well, yeah, I think you just answered your question in a way, or unanswered it, because I think part of the understanding of accompaniment is that we are global.
Yeah.
I think I'm sorry about these phrases, but the old way of thinking about it is global mission is anywhere else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rather than seeing that mission is all kind of cut from the same cloth, that what God is calling us to do, in a general sense, is the same the world over. Now, how that gets implemented and what the priorities are differ according to the needs and the resources and the particularities of a place. One of the things that's different is that the ELCA's ministry in Wilmer, Minnesota, is global mission because the U.S. is part of the globe, and in that sense, we as the local church, we have a particular vision for what that ministry should be, and maybe we invite companion churches from other parts of the world to help us implement that vision. I think an example of that recently is that I think it was in New Jersey. I'm not really sure. In New Jersey, there was an immigrant population, Portuguese-speaking. Some Brazilian, some from the Cape Verde Islands, I think, from the other places, Africans from Angola and Mozambique, but a large Portuguese-speaking community in Newark or New Jersey City, I'm not exactly sure where, but it's somewhere in New Jersey. And the ELCA invited a Portuguese-speaking pastor, I believe from Brazil, to come and be the pastor to that community because the language was already there. A lot of the cultural things were already there. Rather than having, you know, trying to integrate that group into initially into a English-speaking congregation that where there wouldn't be as much of an opportunity to reach out and to meet their needs. So in that sense, it moves us away from saying this is us and mission is to them, but that God's mission is for everyone, and the way that it gets worked out is that the local church, when we're the local church, we as the members of that church listen for God's vision, watch for God's vision, and implement it in our place. And local churches in, you know, Senegal or Tanzania, Madagascar, they know and listen to God's vision and voice for what God is calling them to do in their places of ministry, their context, their home, and see what they can do and what they need others to help them do, and call upon the ELCA and other mission companions, the churches in Europe, for instance, to help them implement that, but based on their own vision. So, yeah, thank you. Yes?
I guess the question that comes to my mind is, in Senegal, do you work strictly with the Lutheran congregations, or are you working with congregations of other denominations, which is a sort of a further extension of working with other
denominations? Sure, yeah. Well, as I said, we'll get into some of those specifics Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, but for a very brief answer, we work in a number of different ways in Senegal. The three main ways that ELCA is active, and why we have three more sessions, the three main ways that ELCA is active in Senegal, one is with a direct outreach and accompaniment of a group of Fulani Christians. These are Christians from a Muslim background, from the Fulani ethnic group, who are not attached to a local Lutheran church and barely attached to one another. They're still at the first stages of their own Christian walk and Christian organization. So a very sort of brand new Christian community and outreach with and around them. A second way that we are engaged in accompaniment is accompanying an organization, several organizations that do community development in education, healthcare, and agriculture. That organization is not a church per se, although it has church backing and church funding, but it's a separate organization that we're accompanying. And then the third group we accompany is the Lutheran Church of Senegal, local Lutheran church that was not founded by ELCA or its predecessors, but founded by other missionaries from Finland in this case, and that has now just very recently, just in the last couple of years, invited the ELCA into a formal sort of relationship of accompaniment to work with them. And so this is why I think the idea of variations on a theme, we have each of these three things, and even the third, which seems like the most sort of like the third option or the third variation that seems the most like the kind of standard implementation of accompaniment. Even there are variations that make it a little bit less than exactly how accompaniment looks in the rest of the church.
A question about that.
Yeah.
I assume you'll come back to this later, but did that Finnish influence come in there at the same time it went into Southwest Africa?
I don't know about the
I mean, this would have been shortly before the turn of the century.
No, then no. The Finnish influence began in 1975. So about the same time that the American Lutheran Church arrived in Senegal, 75, 76. So in both cases, it's a very recent action. Maybe if there's one other question or comment, we can go on. Okay. To draw your attention to the very last page of the handout, just to talk a little bit more about these this change of perception, and just a little parenthesis with a commercial break. We have several copies of the DVD that's referred to in the first paragraph of this page that are available if people want to see those. To have the Executive Director of Global Mission for the ELCA Global Mission Unit, Rafael Malpica Padilla, speaking a little bit more about what accompaniment is and drawing out some particular examples of that. And on that DVD also, missionaries from various parts of the world talking about how some of that is implemented in their context. So yeah, I have those available, and we can distribute those at the end too if you have need of that or want to see that. But as Raphael points out in his talk, accompaniment isn't exactly a, it's not a theology in and of itself. It's not a new sort of theology that's been constructed to talk about global mission, but rather sort of a new attitude, a new point of view, a new way of thinking about the way that we've been doing things all the time, and a new way of kind of prioritizing or reprioritizing our actions. And this list on the back on page 8, I think is a really interesting and enlightening list about where we're moving from and to in looking at the way that mission has been done in the past, or has been imagined or talked about or perceived, to the way that it's being imagined or talked about or perceived in now. And so just to go down that list, moving from establishing to accompany, a lot of the more evangelical missions that we run across, evangelical with a capital E, and we're certainly evangelical, but the American sort of fundamentalist groups that we encounter in Senegal, when you ask them what kind of work they're in, most of the reply you hear most of the time is church planting. The team, church planting. The teams that arrive in Senegal from missions from, well, a number of different mission organizations that we encounter that are there, that's the main work that they see themselves as doing, church planting. Where the work that we're doing in Senegal is not that. There is a Lutheran church that is planted in Senegal. And so what we want to do is to accompany that church. There is also a Christian community among the Fulani that's already firmly planted, or somewhat firmly planted, in Senegal. And what we feel called to do is accompany that organization, that community, that congregation, and the group doing community development. That's already been established, and now we're looking to accompany as the Senegalese are making more and more of the decisions. So that's one of the big changes in perceptions that that we see as we move to the accompaniment model. The second on that list is the dependent church, moving to the four selves church. Does anyone know what the four selves refers to? I don't recall if it's in this paper per se, but we can look at that briefly. There was a mission movement in the early part of the 20th century that talked about the goal of mission is that local churches, once planted and established, would be described by four adjectives beginning with the word self. And just to make sure I get them all here and don't miss one. The first is self-propagating, meaning that it is now the local church that is that has the vision, that has the responsibility for spreading the gospel in their local area. So they are self-propagating is the first one. The second one is self-governing, that the local churches don't have missionaries as bishops or presidents or in charge of things, but it's the local leadership that is raised up and that is empowered, that is in charge of decision-making within that local church. The third is self-supporting. Perhaps one of the trickiest ones, because one of that is that's financial support along with other things. That a church, the structure of the church is there to support itself and relying from time to time, I suppose, on companions and other partners, but more and more self-sufficient, self-supporting. And then the fourth self is self-articulating, closely related perhaps to self-propagating, but also self-articulating in that it's the leaders of the Senegalese church, for instance, that speak for the Senegalese church. That I don't speak, being a missionary in Senegal, for instance, I don't speak as a leader of the Senegalese church. That's up to the Senegalese leaders to articulate their vision, to set up their programs of ministry, to be involved in their planning and their future references and things like that. So self-propagating, self-governing, self-supporting, and self-articulating. Those are the four selves. And so moving from dependent to to independent or perhaps better interdependent, that there still is a need for churches to depend on one another, but not dependency in the sense that the Senegalese church could not exist if it were not led by, financed by, decisions made by foreign missionaries, that this is the way that we're trying to move in our perception of missionary mission work. Moving also from my own story and God's story, the missionary's story and God's story, to a shared story, our story, seeing where my story, my encounter with Christ, intersects with someone else's encounter with Christ, like that Road to Emmaus story, and that in that intersection we see that Christ's story is there, that Christ is walking with us, and that in the breaking of the bread and in the sharing of the resources through that breaking of the bread, that we see that God, not only that Christ is with us now, but has been with us even before we may have realized it. Anyway, there's more from and to in this list there as well. I can go quickly from the pearl merchant to the treasure hunter. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I think the idea of discovering the resources that are there rather than going to extract the resources from the place to sell them somewhere else. Over there to everywhere, dependency to ecosystems, colonial to egalitarian, short-term to sustainable, charity to justice, from talking to listening, teacher to active learner, and from suggesting to comprehending. So each of those probably we could take a very, very long time on doing. But the main thing is beginning to see how we look at what we're doing and changing our perception of that.
Yeah, in reading this, the Emmaus story again, the one thing that struck me this morning is that there was the one group walking down the road, and then there was the other group that was back in the room, and then at the end, they end up sharing different stories, but it's of the same resurrection. And I think that's a wonderful image for us, that we all have different paths. We all have gone different directions. But the stories that we say, and you were saying here just a minute ago, I have my story and your story, now we have our story, but really that story is plural. There are many stories, it's all the same resurrection, but it's many stories. And I think it gives us the opportunity for many ways of recognizing Christ. I think that's another key concept in this model and in this story is recognition and being open to recognizing Christ in many different ways. The people that we have worked with in Senegal have a much different story. And I can't even say they all have the same story, they have many different stories. But one of them is that some of the Fulani Christians, and for those of you who don't know, the Fulani have been Muslim for hundreds and hundreds of years. Fulani is almost synonymous with Muslim. And some of our colleagues 10 years ago went to Northern Africa to work and to study as Muslims. And while they were there, for various reasons, some stemming from racism and from prejudices within the Muslim faith, decided that they could not be Muslim anymore and wanted to find out more about Christianity. And as a result of that, became Christian. Eventually came back to Senegal, now as a Fulani Christian, which is in some ways a paradox in itself. But that's what Peter is talking about when we're looking at a company. Who are these people? We didn't convert them. But now they're back in a setting where they're not the norm. They're a Fulani Christian, which is a paradox. And so how do we accompany them in their Christian life from the day-to-day where they've had this conversion and this new recognition and they've brought this new story? And so that's part of what we'll be talking about tomorrow. But I think it's interesting, and it's not just a global thing. It can be a domestic thing, like you were saying, Carol. We all have different stories, and we all have different recognitions, and how those can complement each other. And when we say a new accompaniment model, it almost seems like a no-brainer to us. Of course, this is the way we should be going.
on an individual basis, it's easy to see how that matches up. It's easy to see how we can walk next to our neighbor, or like with Larsh, we can accompany or mentor someone. What becomes a challenge then is when you take it from the individual level to a communal level, or even to international government level, bureaucratic level. And that's where we find some challenges and it gets messy. And the nice, simple illustration of walking down the road together and sharing stories is hard. It's hard to maintain the integrity of that model. That's what we'll get into in the next couple of days. But perhaps some of you were struck by some of those images in that passage as well. And since Peter asked the question about accompaniment and what you've experienced in global mission or domestic mission, like we said, we're all part of the globe. Have you other thoughts?
Well, I had a question which emerged over the course of this conversation. In the story, in the paradigm, there are two people who are obviously friends of one another, for as far as we know, all the way back, you know, and they're just having a conversation among friends. And there's an implicit either request or butting in the missionary model of, you know, you're coming from somewhere far away, you don't know these people initially. So I'm curious about that relationship between imposition and request, historically, and how you bridge that gap with this more inclusive model that we're talking about. Like, is it a matter of transforming a relationship, or is it a matter of starting fresh with new relationships? And if so, what is the request? What do they want from their accompaniment, those that accompany them?
Companions.
Their companion.
Right. One thing that I think of, and I think that's you've really touched on what makes it difficult in the implementation, is that that it's human beings and human relationships, and no two relationships are alike, and none of us can say, okay, forget everything we've done before, we're going to start over. You know, that would be great if we could. We've often, as we're making a move, in particular in Senegal right now, where we have been working in parallel with the local church. And we'll get into that. I hope that you're able to join us for these other things. This is our advertisement. We've been working in parallel and now are wanting to work more directly with the local Lutheran church. And we have sometimes joked, and sometimes it's not even that much of a joke, really suggested, if we're going to really make that change, all of us who are there now need to leave and wait to be invited back. Because we're asking for the relationship to change when those who have had the relationship are the same human beings who are still there. And so this is kind of getting around to your question there, but in the same way, the sort of moving from an imposition, even with good motives, you know, the imposing a certain thing versus the request and the invitation. It's much easier if there never was the other and the new thing is happening out of the blue. If a church, for instance, that is founded, however it was founded, suddenly knocks on the door, so to speak, of the ELCA and says, we want you to help us. Here's what we want, what we think you could help us with, theological education, and we need a veterinarian who's going to work in our agriculture program. We've got this, that, scholarships, things like that. And sometimes it is that specific, that churches come with very specific needs. And other times, people come and say, we think that you can help us, but we're not really sure how. And part of the work of the relationship is to have these kind of conversations where, well, it sounds like what you're saying is you want leadership development. We could probably help you with that, with someone who would be able to implement that. So some of it is pretty messy, and it seems to me some of the messiest places is where the old paradigm is so entrenched, and that you just can't say, well, on Tuesday we'll do the old paradigm, and now starting Wednesday at 8 a.m., we're going to be doing something different. And
it's
almost
parental.
Yeah.
It's like it's moved.
Sure.
It's evolving.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, you know, part of the problematic of that metaphor, as real as that feels, is that's what it has been, is this parental, paternalistic, patronizing, colonial sort of model that it, when it stays too long.
And then evolving into a different relationship with someone who is now an adult,
right,
or who is,
right,
has an independent, their own independent
view of the world.
Yeah, and a very specific, I'm sorry, I don't want to cut off any more other questions, but very specific example of this in Senegal, the person who's now the president of the church, so like the bishop of the national church, was baptized by a Finnish missionary who's still working in Senegal. Well, for the person who, you know, you're the person who brought the Christian faith to me, who baptized me, literally, physically, you're the one who poured the water on my head, and now I'm supposed to be in charge and tell you what to do? I mean, it's just a hard sort of human relationship to work out. There was a question over here, one that, yes, in the back.
Perhaps more of a comment.
Okay.
There seems to me be an opening here for you to come back. Because what you describe and what you have in your list on page 8 is an important element of a personal relationship in any relationships we have.
Sure.
And then you made a very interesting comment that yes, it's relatively easy on a personal level, it's much harder on an institutional level. And I see some of these problems in our church in the United States, whether it's in our congregations, whether it's in the synod, whether it's in the national body. And perhaps there is something that can be applied back from what you're describing in a far place to something that we very much need at home also.
Well, one of the things that I think is necessary in the process is a sense of humility. And I think the model that was before requires us to adopt renew a sense of humility. I think in the process of deciding how we change that model and how we walk together requires a sense of humility on both sides. And it's hard to do that. I mean, we're proud Americans, and we work with people who are very proud in their own heritage and their own religion. So how do you build trust, which is maybe another key element, how do you build enough trust so that you can be vulnerable to each other to figure out a way that you're going to transfer that leadership and that power? I don't know if you don't have reactions to that. That's just what's coming up. But it's definitely over there and here as well, everywhere. Sorry.
Well, and it also seems like it's complicated when you talk about power. So you also have to bear in mind the economic power that has also come behind, particularly mission work that has been health related and other projects, building community centers and things where there has been a financial stream, and there still should be that financial stream, but how do you do that in a relationship with the resources?
And how to do it without kind of almost in spite of yourself falling back into the trap of dependency and power over by saying, no, I won't pretend to make a decision for the church, but ELCA will fund this and not that. Right. So here's the decision we're not making for you, but somehow making for you, you know, and to kind of do this dance around some of those. And as we'll say in our Thursday session, one of the things that we're dancing around right now within the Senegalese church is trying to get, this will be caricatured, but trying to get the Senegalese church to invite us to do the things that we're already doing. And it's like, whoa, okay, so that, because that fits better the paradigm. We want them to invite us, but, you know, here's the 9 things we're doing. Won't you please invite me to do those now? You know, and that's why that whole idea about maybe it would be better if we all went home and waited for the call. Here's a hand in the back, yeah.
Well, following up with Kamika, I should say, I think that, you know, if we're going to use this model internationally, we very definitely have to see it domestically as well.
Yeah.
And I have to be very honest and say that, for example, within our church right now, we are redoing our constitution.
Within your congregation, you mean?
Our congregation, right. Church. And the ELCA has a model that we are, quote unquote, required to follow. Hmm. So if they say, if the philosophy is that this is what is doing internationally, and we're not holding power, we're walking together, I am going to say very strongly, this is not the model that they are following domestically within our church today. So it would be very difficult for me to say, you are talking out of both sides of your mouth, because you know they are using this power structure on very strongly on a domestic scene within the U.S. So
theoretically, the National Church should get its power from us. Mm-hmm. It should be essentially substantially. They only get what we give to them in terms of power. It's like any kind of organization. If it should be at the grassroots, that's what she's sounding. It's not saying it's sounding like it's the other way around.
Right.
And so there should be a rebellion and some sort of revolution. I'm serious. Unless someone at the bottom says this is not right.
Right. Well, but yeah.
I have a question. Is accompaniment the model that is now being encouraged globally for those countries that are sending missionaries? And the reason that I ask is that the congregation or the area of New Guinea that we experienced that previously had the ELCA pastor that we went with very much followed the accompaniment. But then the as you talk about bureaucracy, then the national Lutheran Church of New Guinea invited missionaries from another country, and they always had missionaries from different countries who came in and kind of squashed all the work that our accompaniment pastor did and came in with the old paradigm of this is our way and our story and this is where you need to fit into it. And so is this paradigm becoming international? Are those discussions happening so that we're all doing missionary work internationally as a Lutheran church in the same manner?
My sense is that it's a yes and no, like so many things. But a lot of the accompaniment language is shared within the Lutheran World Federation, which is not a communion of churches. So it's more of a collection of churches who hold the Lutheran Confession as their identity, and there's agreements within that body more and more. If I'm understanding right, that more and more of these bodies are trying to follow the same sort of paradigm, the same sort of model. But the LWF is not a legislature. It's not an enforcing and a policy setting organization. It's more of a collection of autonomous, independent Lutheran churches. So it's an agreement, and people choose to implement that agreement differently. I mean, in many ways, not the best parallel, but like the United Nations. The United Nations has resolutions, they can be unanimous, and people follow it differently, and some choose to completely ignore it. And so it's that kind of struggle. But I think the trend is more and more that Lutheran churches in North America and Europe are tending more and more, whether it's exactly the same language or not, but in that model. And we see that in our cooperation with the Finnish Lutheran Mission, that's the other Lutheran Mission organization that's active in Senegal, that they have, in the last 5 years, drastically shifted the way they talk about mission, the way they send missionaries. Missionaries are only sent at the invitation of the local church and things like that. So, yeah.
I want to thank you for your contributions to the conversation this morning. Remind you again of the information that's available up here. And ask that you take out this handout again, and we're going to close with the prayers, which is on the right-hand column. Let's stand as we read. Does everyone have one or can see one? Let's read it together. God, our companion on the journey,
let us not be so caught up in worldly cares that we forget that you are with us everywhere. Open our eyes that we may meet you in the people squashed against us in the crowded bus, in the weary shoppers elbowing their way towards the counter, in the sightseers sauntering along the pavements, in the beggars squatting in their squalid corners, in the noisy children kicking an old tin can, and the lonely pensioner peering out the roaring window. O God, our companion, let us never forget that you are with us everywhere.
Thank you very much. We've been asked to just announce our name at the end because they didn't turn the tape on in time. So we're Peter Hansen and Sarah Groh talking about accompaniment in Senegal, and we endorse this message.